Hello, everyone. It's Arjorie, and you are listening to Why We Do the Work. And today I have Mason on the show, and we're going to talk about that hot, hot topic that I was telling you about right before winter break, and that's gas stations. We're going to talk about their pollution, the impact of their pollution on public health, leaking underground storage tanks, how a gas station moratorium might work, and what's happening in Eugene locally. So Mason, thank you so much for being on the show. You know, I said it before we started recording. I really enjoy you being on the show. I like you having a little space here. It's a lot of fun for me. And I think that's something that Crystal and you and myself talked about when we recorded the first time, is to maybe have you be a little cameo that comes back. And I think that our conversations and our relationship, even though we're not around each other a whole lot, is pretty fun. So thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. I am here anytime. Just shoot me a text and I'm down to be on the show. I have such a fun time as well.
Crystal is always back there behind the scenes, you guys. I didn't get a chance up at the top to talk about how we want to thank Beyond Toxics for sponsoring this podcast, because we wouldn't be able to do it without Beyond Toxics. And as always, Crystal is back there behind the scenes and she does all the magic and makes this sound so wonderful. So thank you, Crystal. You can find out all the wonderful things that the rest of the team are doing at beyondtoxics.org. And you can meet Mason there. You can meet Crystal. You can see Lisa, our executive director. Everybody's there. And you can always reach me at aab@beyondtoxics.org. I want to start out by asking a really simple question just to get our conversation going here and get us oriented about where it is that we're going to have this conversation. And that is, can you explain to me what ambient air pollution is? What does that have to do with gas stations?
Well, air pollution is all around us in different concentrations. There's different types of air pollution. And so ambient air pollution sort of tries to capture the fact that there's a lot of different sources of pollution that are just existing around us. So another way of thinking about it is kind of background air pollution, although I think that makes it sound less consequential. So it's just the pollution that's kind of all around us as a result of our transportation system, any factories you live near, your dry cleaner, the bakery next door, whatever it may be, we all contribute to this ambient air pollution.
You said the bakery next door. So when I moved to Eugene, I lived down on campus and there was a bakery down there and I can't remember what the name of it was at this point. So you don't imagine that a bakery is polluting, really. Like, you're smelling the nice fresh bread. So when you say ambient air about those in particular, I'm curious because I don't know, I didn't think that bread factories were doing anything that was polluting anything. So their ambient air is doing stuff then.
Yeah, no, it does contribute. I do think, you know, I'd rather live next to a bakery than J.H. Baxter. So they're very different in that sense. But, you know, turning those ovens on and running all of that does produce air pollution. It's just less consequential than that of a wood treatment facility in terms of public health. I actually wrote about this for my first newsletter at Beyond Toxics when I started about 2 years ago. I used a bakery versus a wood treatment plant as an example to talk about ambient air pollution. And we talked about it in that it changes across space. So the ambient air pollution standing on Roosevelt Boulevard next to all of the industrial facilities in Eugene is very different than the bakery I always pictured when I talked about this is Hideaway Bakery in South Eugene, because that was the place I was frequenting at the time. And so South Eugene doesn't have any industrial facilities and things like that. So the ambient air pollution down there is very different. But then we can generalize ambient air pollution to the county level or the Willamette Valley and talk about it that way. Or we can talk about air pollution as a global phenomena when we think about global warming and how impacts of that type of air pollution are felt across the world well, acutely in some places due to, you know, hurricanes and rising sea levels, but it doesn't matter where the greenhouse gas came from. It affects the world's climate the same. But the same cannot be said of the public health impacts from living next to a gas station or an industrial facility. Those are felt much more closely and consequentially by neighbors of those facilities.
Yeah, it's not fresh smelling bread that's coming out of those factories. That's not fresh bread that we're smelling. So we have these gas pumps, and we've had a conversation, you and I and Alyssa, about gas in your house from stoves and ovens. And so are the gases that are coming from the gas pumps, what is the difference between that and the gas that's coming from our stoves? Is it different?
Yeah, I mean, of course it's different in some ways. One way to look at it is one's a liquid and one's a gas, right? But they're also very similar. And I'm not a chemist. I don't know everything there is to know about.
You do.
But I do. I have to be clear for the audience. I've read a lot of public health studies on both of these phenomena done by very highly held scientific institutions like Stanford and Harvard and Berkeley. So I'm not uninformed. But to answer your question, there is a lot of similarities. So one of the chemicals that comes to mind that's really detailed in these science reports is benzene. And you and I have talked about benzene a lot. Benzene causes blood cancer. It makes your immune system worse, and attack itself over long periods of chronic exposure or high exposure levels in short periods of time. And benzene is in natural gas, and it's produced when you burn natural gas. And the same thing is true of gasoline and petroleum. I'm going to call it petroleum for this podcast so that we can differentiate between, you know, natural gas and liquid gas. So benzene is in petroleum, and it is produced by burning petroleum. And it is a hydrocarbon, right? Comprised of carbon and hydrogen molecules. And fossil fuels are hydrocarbons. Not all hydrocarbons are acutely toxic for us just as much as benzene is, but it's a really great example. And there are others. There's toluene, ethylene, ethylbenzene, xylene, and these are linked to the use of gas stoves and petroleum. Mm-hmm. So what's important to remember is both of these are fossil fuels. They are produced by decomposing organisms over millions of years, and they're extracted through fracking and oil drilling, right? All of the same. And then they are used to produce energy, whether that's driving the engine of your car or heating your food and cooking it.
Well, you sound like a scientist to me, Mason. You're very knowledgeable. So thank you for saying all that and explaining it, because I don't know, you know, I didn't really too much know the difference. So I know that folks that might be listening to this will think, okay, gas in my house, gas in my car, you know, what's the difference? So let's talk about gas stations. What kind of impacts, what kind of health impacts are we facing from gas station emissions? And is it the same sort of impacts that can happen to you from having gas in your home as living next to a gas station?
So I'm going to put these impacts into two buckets. We're going to call them chronic and acute. I'm going to call chronic impacts of gas stations are ones that you experience as a result of just living next to, let's say, a perfectly functioning gas station, one that follows all the rules and all of the pollution control mechanisms, right? Benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene still get into the air in the best case scenarios. And they linger around in the ambient air to a max distance of, you know, 1,000 feet around gas stations. There have been many reports that find toxic concentrations of benzene hovering up to about 525 feet away from a gas station. Ones that we know are just straight up bad for people. So they just linger around, and that's by nature of the gas just being there. And gasoline interacts in a gas station in a lot of different ways. So big tanker trucks come in filled with petroleum products, including diesel and gasoline, and it is put into giant underground storage tanks. And through that process, all of the gasoline is tossed and it's shaken around. And because of that, some of it turns into a gas vapor, right? Can you think of that sweet, bright, chemically smell? You smell at a gas station and you go, oh, that's the smell of gas. And you know, some people really like that and some people really don't. Those are the vapors. And they're produced because of what's called volatilization. So you and I have talked about on this podcast before, volatile organic compounds, or VOCs. And it's a group of pollutants that's characterized by their ability to volatilize from a liquid to a gas state really easily. So shaking it up and, you know, transferring it to your car is one easy way to get it to volatilize a lot more. And same thing with the tanker truck to the underground storage tank. But it also just volatilizes by nature of evaporation, just like how, you know, you set water out on a hot day or even over a long period of time in a dry climate, it eventually evaporates. Gasoline sort of does the same thing, and it does so in cold environments, but it evaporates more in hotter environments during the summer. And so gasoline is just sitting in the bottom of this underground storage tank, and it evaporates slowly and goes up through these pipelines and escapes into the air around gas stations. And so living next to them or playing outside next to them, you're going to be exposed to these ambient air pollutions. And I'm going to call this chronic exposure because it happens over a long period of time, and these are unavoidable realities of having gas stations in urban environments near residential parks and schools. And so those same, to get back to your original question, that same thing is true during, you know, chronic exposure to byproducts produced by natural gas infrastructure and stoves, right? You're continuously burning it, cooking it. It leaks over time, as you and I discussed. It just slowly escapes even when not in use. Mm-hmm. And so you're exposed to that regardless. And then you and I can get into acute health impacts. Some of those might be explosions, or, you know, in the case of gas stoves, you can have a really bad malfunctioning gas stove and produce a ton of carbon monoxide, which can be poisonous and deadly, which is why we have carbon monoxide alarms. And we'll call those maybe more acute impacts.
Okay. Yeah. Every time we're talking about gas stoves, I'm always thinking about my stove from 1990. And I have my whole, it's not 1990 anymore, folks. My landlady replaced it. But my whole family is now trained to turn the fan on and open the window before we're doing stuff. Like, all of us do it. And I'll see them and I'm like, I'm so proud because we can notice, and I'll show them, hey, this air purifier is yellow right now. As soon as I turn the stove on, it's doing stuff. And they're like, okay, I can see that. So my whole family is trained to do it, and I'm so proud of them for participating in that, because it's like, okay, they're listening to my work, which I think is pretty awesome.
That is pretty awesome. I have noticed that my roommates have started doing it too. We have a gas stove in my house, so I was shocked a couple of times to see them opening windows and turning on the vents when they were cooking. I was like, oh, like, I'm rubbing off on y'all.
Isn't it neat? Like, oh, you're paying attention. So, and Mason, is there a certain age that we're worried about? Like, I know that when we're talking about some of the wood byproducts that have come, and we've talked about J.H. Baxter a bunch on this podcast, and there's a certain age, there's the younger ones, 6 and under, that can be more susceptible to the negative impacts. Is there an age that we're concerned about living close to gas stations?
Yes, people of all ages, for sure. But when you begin to talk about kids or elderly, or maybe across ages, people with, you know, chronic conditions such as asthma or chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, COPD, they're going to be more impacted by that. So there have been a lot of studies that have concretely tied living next to a gas station to negative health outcomes, particularly for children. And that's goes back to, you know, a fundamental principle, which is that kids have smaller bodies. Mm-hmm. And so they, when they breathe in or are exposed to pollution in other ways, it's more concentrated in their body because it's smaller than an adult. So that's the reason usually why kids are more impacted by these sources of pollution.
What I want to ask you is, so we're concerned about it getting into to people. You know, we don't want people living near to it. What about livestock? Are they impacted? Like, you probably haven't studied livestock, but did you look to see what might be getting in our food?
I think about this, I guess, in a, I have looked into this in a couple of other realms of pollution unrelated to fossil fuels. I imagine if there's petroleum contamination, you know, in places, I don't know, like, how livestock would be, you know, inadvertently exposed to that or something like that. And then the second question is how long does something remain in a body and is it bioaccumulative? So when we're talking about pollution, there's a couple of different types of risk. One is pollutants just being in our body and maybe getting out of it, you know, through exhaling or going to the bathroom, right? Mm-hmm. Some of the pollutants might leave our body that way, but some pollution is bioaccumulative, meaning it nestles and begins to accumulate and increase over time in our bodies. So benzene's actually one of those examples. So this is, you know, hotly contested in science. A lot of scientists want to make the argument that no amount of benzene is a safe amount of benzene because it accumulates in the body over time and its risks grow over time. The same thing with like microplastics and PFAS, right? Mm-hmm. This is unrelated to gasoline and fossil fuels. I mean, in some ways, fossil fuels are used to produce plastics. Yeah, so it's related, but maybe not as related to gas stations. Those accumulate, you know, in our bodies over time. And particularly when we think about PFAS and microplastics with livestock and our food system, those are known to accumulate in plants and then, you know, or in fish or whatever, right? And make it through us back to our food system. But I haven't seen any research that looks specifically at fossil fuel toxins, and nor have I tried to. So admittedly, I haven't even tried to answer your question. So I'm gonna give this one a solid, I don't know, but I do know about PFAS and microplastics.
Well, that's okay. I'm just curious. I think about gas a lot when I'm cooking. I'm constantly thinking about it. I'm like,
And I will say, you know, I think to the fact that this is a bit of an assumption, but I think it's a cleaner assumption, right? I think you and I, because we spend so much time in this space and in coalitions and in groups that are really concerned about this, I think the reason why that air pollution is so focused on is because air pollution is the number one source of exposure. So this is to say that I think of food were like a really big concern of exposure when it comes to byproducts of natural gas and gasoline. That would be the focus. But as you and I will get into in the podcast, when we do have gasoline make it into the environment, we do take care of it in a very stringent manner for the most part. And that would preclude it from ending up in our food system. So maybe that's not a concern because we have a system of management, but we'll talk about the pros and cons of that system of management eventually.
Yeah, it's a curiosity for me. How many gas stations are there in Eugene and where are they most likely to be located? Like, where's an overabundance?
Yeah, so there are 56 gas stations by my count. And the way I counted is I went to the Lane Regional Air Protection Agency, which is an air pollution regulatory government body in Lane County. And I asked them for all of their air pollution permits for petroleum dispensing facilities. And I got a list of 56. And so to be clear, these 56 include some ones that you and I can't bring in our cars to. There's a couple of ones that are exclusively for long haul freight and trucks. And then there's a couple of ones run by 4J for their school bus fleet. So those are included in the counts. oh, another good example is there's a couple at the airport for rental cars, and you can only use those if you're using a rental car, right? So I still included those because they're important, but they are slightly different from a commercial gas facility. So there were about 5 or 6 of those by my count. So that still leaves about 50 gas stations that we need to be thinking about in terms of a public use. I know we're going to get into this, but the city counts 42 gas stations, and we're not quite sure why they're missing some on their list, but that's been a question we get a lot from reporters.
So where are the most of those gas stations? When you were counting them up, where did you find the most?
Thank you for re-prompting me with that question, because it was a really important one. So a lot of them, you know, generally are going to be along big transit corridors, right? So just off of I-5 or on Coburg or on Franklin, West 6, West 7th, 11th, Highway 99. Those of you who are familiar with Eugene are going to know a lot of these streets. Or if you don't know them, you're driving on them a whole lot. But the location of gas stations are dictated also by zoning and not just by, you know, where arterial streets are. So there are a couple of sections of Eugene that don't have zoning that allow for gas stations. So, for example, in South Eugene, there's a very limited amount of commercial 2 zoning, which allows for gas stations. And there's a lot of commercial 1, which doesn't. Near campus in East Eugene, along like Hilliard and Patterson, like near the hospital area, there is an overlay zone which bans any type of automobile infrastructure, which includes gas stations and like car mechanic shops. And they were banned because they thought it negatively affected the character of the area. Yeah, I know this is quite ironic, as we'll get into. But, you know, you and I have talked about West Eugene a lot. And when you look at the zoning, most gas station zoning or areas where gas stations are allowed are in West Eugene, along West 11th and Highway 99, just like our industrial facilities. So we can even like zoom in a little bit more. One location that has a lot of gas stations is Roosevelt Boulevard and Highway 99 on that intersection. There's one on each corner.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. Like, who needs that? And we've talked about this. It's not like there were long lines. Like, it's not like people were waiting like even 10 minutes or 5 to get into a gas station, right? You know, but there's 4 on that corner. And when you and I get into public health impacts, you might think 2 gas stations is twice as bad, right? Like 1 plus 1. Okay, 1 times 2, like it's 2 times as worse. It's actually exponential. Like 2 gas stations is so much worse than just 2 gas stations once, because their ambient air pollution mixes and concentrates to a higher degree. So 3 or 4 gas stations right next to each other is a way larger health impact. So it's an exponential health impact. It's not cumulative.
What makes them think that it's smart to, I mean, not just because like we know it's not smart to have all those right there, but it's like there's so much competition. But I'm thinking like when I'm driving by a place and there's a gas station right across the street and they have the same gas prices, I'm like, what? That doesn't make sense to me. I could see if it was like $1 less or 50 cents less, and everybody's going to want to go to that gas station because it's less, but it's like ridiculous. It's stupid to me that you would do that.
Oh, well, and like, I think this is so important because like, it doesn't make sense to us. And like, for you and me as consumers and as residents, I think this is important to highlight. It really doesn't add any convenience for us. Like it really doesn't make our quality of life better in terms of easier accessibility for gas stations. So it is strange.
So first of all, I've never seen a sign when you're doing gas that gas can cause you to have this. You know, like you have on the pack of cigarettes, you have the Surgeon General's warning or whatever it is. I've never seen a sign that says gas is going to do this to you, or I've never seen that. And I'm wondering, how much of a risk is it not only for people living close to gas stations, but for the people that actually work there? You know, they're constantly being exposed to that. So, you know, obviously their chances of getting a negative health impact is going to be higher. But now that we're able to pump our own gas, which I don't even know how to pump gas. I'll teach you someday. I go to the full service. I don't know. There's too many buttons. The last time I pumped gas was, there weren't that many buttons. And so there's a lot. So how concerned are we about the people that are working there? How informed are these people that are working there? Because a lot of times these are low-income people that are working in these gas stations, and they're doing it because they need a job. And they're not thinking about what that gas is doing to them. They're thinking about putting food on their tables. So, I mean, I don't even necessarily think that's a question. That is just something that I've noticed, that I've never seen anything that says that the way that it does on a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah, let's get into this. So I had that same thought as you did, right? And so now when I go to gas stations, I'm squinting, I'm reading all of that tiny print on, you know, the stall and the pump. And for the first time ever, I think it was about a month ago, I finally noticed a warning, and it was in very, very tiny print at the very bottom of this lawn official, you know, government clearly mandated thing, right, that no one reads. And it said that that use of gas stations and vapors from gas stations are cleanly linked as a cause of cancer, very clearly. And so, Audrey, like, your example of the cigarette packet is so clear, right? You know, you can't ignore that warning, whereas this, you have to look for the warning. And I actually thought about this example before I came on the show today. There was one time when I was in California, and I was in a parking garage, and there was a big sign in the middle of the parking garage that says, scientists have repeatedly found higher rates of carbon monoxide and carcinogens present in parking garages. Please limit your amount of time in here. And that makes sense, because people idle their car in closed parking garages, and that creates a lot of ambient pollution that's trapped inside of those spaces, right? So I have the same question as you. Why don't I see these things at gas stations? I don't have an answer. I'm sure there's a marketing reason, and maybe this was debated at some point whether or not to put a warning on there. But well, clearly it was, because there was a warning. It's just in really tiny prints. But that warning's probably not effective. Your second question of, like, are workers warned about this? I actually don't know the answer to that, and that's something I've thought a lot about. But I do have a piece of related information that might shed some light on the situation. When I was looking through leaking underground storage tank records and how those cleanups are handled, I encountered a very common type of standard for public health impacts in the United States. And that is that workers, regardless of their occupation, if it's a retail clerk, if you're a cook, if you work in an office like us, or if you work on an industrial site, you're allowed to be exposed to more pollution no matter what, right? Like, generally, as a rule of thumb, if there's a worker's standard and a residential standard for pollution exposure, the worker is always astronomically higher than the residential standard. And so I encountered this repeatedly when I was looking at risks of petroleum contamination to public health from leaking underground storage tanks. Worker exposure for benzene is way higher. So I immediately, as a researcher and as, you know, a person in my position, I wonder, you know, when were those laws created? Was it explicitly created because we knew workers would be exposed to more, and to have lower standards that are equal to that of residents would be really difficult to implement, and maybe not something that oil companies want to pay for. So the answer is yes, workers are exposed to higher levels of benzene, and this is documented in science. One really common way that we look at benzene is through sampling your pee. Really? it there's a certain amount that comes out through there. It also bioaccumulates, like we discussed, but some of it, you know, exits that way. And then also in terms of like an acute, like inhaling gas fumes, we exhale some of that benzene that we don't bioaccumulate. And so scientists have had this method of going to people who they breathe in and breathe out. They get a benzene sample. They go and pump their own gas, right, for 30 seconds. And then they go and do a second sample. And the benzene increases, you know, a substantial amount. And so we know that, you know, you and I, as we pump our own gas, we're exposed to benzene. So now I have this habit personally, as I start pumping my gas, and I actually walk away from the pump like 10 feet so that I don't smell it, which, like, just to lower my exposure. I don't know how well-educated workers are about this, but I agree with you that even if they are warned about it, if I'm in a position of just needing to put food on the table, that's going to be one of my last thoughts.
Yeah, you're not going to be thinking about that. Let's talk about leaking underground storage tanks. Like, we've talked about that a little bit. I think this is a great segue into that. First, you talked about it being shaken around and mixed and doing all that. Let's get into that a little bit more. And first, let's tell people what a leaking underground storage tank is. I mean, I know that sounds self-explanatory, but go ahead and lay it out.
Yeah. So below each gas station are usually, you know, depending on the size and the amount of pumps, there's at least two underground storage tanks if they carry diesel and petroleum, because you have to store those separately. But sometimes there's like 3 to 5 underground storage tanks. Costco in Eugene is the biggest gas station that we have here. And so when you look at total gasoline throughput and the largest underground storage tanks in Eugene, they are all grocery stores. Anyhow, these tanks are usually on the measure of 500 gallons to 10,000. They can get quite big. And they're just kind of sitting under there. And that's where our gasoline goes before it's pumped into our car. And it slowly leaks vapors over time. However, leaking underground storage tanks specifically refer to when part of the hole of the gas station has some sort of puncture, or maybe it rusts over time and starts to dribble out. The hoses that connect the underground storage tank to the pump where it goes into your car can also produce leaks. And what happens is petroleum products like gasoline and diesel slowly start to trickle into the groundwater and soil underneath gas stations. And these leaks can be various different sizes, and they can also be really small and leak subtly over years. And they can be hard to discover. Often it's discovered through either some sort of glaring problem. And usually these are the big leaks, right? So a couple of them are discovered in Eugene, according to the records I read through, by visible gasoline in nearby soil plots. And so for a while, maybe someone thought that their pickup truck was leaking, but eventually there was enough gasoline there to where someone went, This is something larger. Or in another case, it was found in bathrooms in nearby buildings, smelled like gasoline. And so that was a discovery cue. And usually those are the bigger leaks. The most common way they're discovered is the gas station closes down, they ran out of business or decided to sell. And so someone begins to excavate and they take off a layer of asphalt. And sure enough, you know, all of that soil is gross and smells like fumes, and you do a couple tests and confirm that there's petroleum products in there.
And that's why when somebody's trying to build that gas station and they sell it to a mom and pop doesn't make it thrive and flourish, and it's a gas station, they abandon it, and then we have this leaky underground storage tank.
If they just exactly abandon. And so I think one relatable case for some older Americans who have experience shopping for homes and buying homes, you may or may not have encountered, especially in an older generation, kerosene storage tanks for heating oil. And so this is a similar phenomena where there's this underground storage tank used to store fossil fuel to heat your home. And there's sort of this little game that sometimes people get to play where you don't want to excavate soil in your yard because you might discover it was leaking. And so sometimes when you're buying a home, there are like these caveats on that there might be an underground storage tank that needs taken care of. Sometimes when they're decommissioned, they're filled with concrete. And so having a record of that tells you that it's an okay home to buy. But anyways, I've talked to a few people recently who've been able to relate to leaking underground storage tanks by way of heating oil under homes. But this was a system of heat that we transitioned to natural gas for a lot of homes. So a lot of homes nowadays are powered by natural gas or electricity. But before that, it was heating oil. And anyways, I think it's a relatable topic. You mentioned, Audrey, one of the important parts of your question was asking like how this risk of a leaking underground storage tank is passed off to mom and pop businesses. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really important because actually in the 50s and 60s, when the U.S. really embraced suburban development and the automobile lifestyle, a lot of gas stations were constructed to support that. And that was a really important transition in terms of our urban planning and attitudes to what a city should look like. And believe it or not, your gas station used to be owned by the oil company. So, you know, like today when we see a Shell station, those are never owned by Shell, the oil company. They're just leasing the name of that oil company, but it used to be owned by them. And then in the 50s and 60s, they started to notice that a lot of their gas stations had leaking underground storage tanks and tried to lobby to Congress to not be financially responsible for those. And then when Congress was like, yes, you do have to pay for all of the pollution that that causes, they went, okay, that makes sense. And then they turned around and started selling the businesses to families, telling them, oh, you know, here's the American dream, right? You can own and have your own business and be your own boss. And look, we already have enough sales to, you know, cover the costs. And then didn't tell a lot of these families about the problems with leaking underground storage tanks. And then the 1980s and 90s, we finally started to regulate them through the Environmental Protection Agency. And a whole lot of people went out of business because of this. And a lot of oil companies, for the most part, escaped without much of a financial penalty for the problem that they caused and instead offloaded that onto a ton of families who went bankrupt as a result of the environmental damage caused by these leaking underground storage tanks. So when we think about polluter accountability, this is a really important, I think, historical tale to look at and think about some of the future ways we might make polluters financially accountable for the damage they cause. One of the things I'm hoping to still do is really look into some of the historical nature of this program and how it went down for Oregon specifically.
So do these underground storage tanks, when they're leaking, does that damage, I think you answered this question just a minute ago, but does that damage go further out than just the gas station? Like, how far spread can it be, and how long does it stay in that soil? Does it stay in the soil? Like, dioxin will stay in the soil? Like, what are we looking at when that's happening?
So I don't have exact answers here, but one of the things I did to write our report is I looked at 303 instances of leaking underground storage tanks in Eugene since 1987. So here's what I learned, Audrey. They frequently contaminate neighboring properties. There's no question about that. And scientists, or I should say, maybe not scientists, environmental consultants hired by gas stations to work with the Department of Environmental Quality to secure a what's called no further action letter, basically a letter from the DEQ that says, you're all good, you're off the hook, you're all clear, you don't need to worry about any further contamination, is a long process and can take decades. So in a couple of instances, we know that this gasoline can get really, really, really far from a gas station. One really great example, and this is on the scarier end of a leaking underground storage tank scenario. This isn't happening all across the city of Eugene or anything like that, but it happens often enough in the US that I think we should consider it to be a bigger reality and problem. So there's this tiny little town in Oregon called Monmouth. That's the home of Western Oregon University. It's a little bit west of Salem, the capital of Oregon, for those of you who don't know. And Monmouth has a population of about 800 to 1300. It's a pretty small town. And on its main street of state and a highway, there was a gas station. And one day it started leaking, and it was a big leak. It was not a small leak. It was leaking hundreds of gallons per hour. And unfortunately, this gas station owner had automated deliveries on, meaning that whenever the tank got low enough, a truck was automatically contracted to come and unload gasoline. And so over the course of 10 days, several tanker trucks were contracted without this business owner looking at the financials and realizing, hold on a second, I am not selling as much gasoline as I'm buying, right? So this business owner totally, you know, just didn't look at the books. And a little bit's on them for that, but come on, you and I have made mistakes like this before too. So after 10 days, 3/4 of a mile away, workers at Monmouth's sewage treatment facility began to notice there was a pervasive smell of gasoline fumes everywhere. Almost a mile away from this gas station. And so they contacted the Department of Environmental Quality and said, hey, like, this is weird. We're a little worried that we're smelling gasoline in the sewage treatment process. And the Department of Environmental Quality got on the line, got down in sight. And I'm not exaggerating this. And you and I, the Department of Environmental Quality is one to usually say, everything's okay, don't worry. You know, they're very cautious in at all characterizing a dangerous situation. They said a wrongly lit match or a cigarette would have turned downtown Monmouth into a fiery, deadly explosion, and that it would have devastated multiple city blocks because the fumes that had accumulated in buildings could have been ignited by a cigarette in the air inside of some office buildings downtown. And so we were so close to burning downtown Monmouth to a crisp from a leak that lasted 10 days. I'm not like getting up and giving a one-time example. This happened in Utah and a couple of other Western states in the last 3 years. It's not common, but it's not unheard of. And this stuff happens. So, you know, this is a story of an acute danger, but it got almost a mile away from the facility, and they're going to have to excavate soil from all across downtown Monmouth to get rid of this. We're talking about a whole lot of business owners being impacted by this and residents being impacted by this. And this brings me.
When did this happen? I didn't mean to interrupt you. When did this happen?
It was 2021.
What?
It was like, dude, I couldn't believe you and I hadn't heard of this. I stumbled across it through like a newspaper article. I was shocked.
I thought you were talking about like 1985 or, you know,
no. Recent. And the one in Utah I talked about was, I'm not remembering the year exactly, but it was 2017, 18 or 19. Like it's not like, these aren't like glaring examples from 50 years ago. These are things happening like yearly to, you know, towns in the United States.
That's what I was going to ask, was how often this happens, but it sounds like, you know, it can happen quite often to have a leaky underground storage tank.
Right. And these are egregious examples, to be clear. These are like the worst of the worst. But I found 303 leaking underground storage tanks since 1987 in Eugene. So if we think about that, that's about 35 years, which means just under 100 storage tanks a decade. I'd love to give a couple of stories, and I think it'll help answer your last question, which is, how long does this petroleum contamination sit around? So we're going to do two stories here. And the first is going to be in the 1990s, there was a car dealership on the corner of Oak Street and 17th Street. So on 18th and Oak Street is the Safeway. And so a lot of that is a good landmark for you. And so if you look across Oak Street from Safeway, you're going to see today there's a Wells Fargo bank and there is a tire store that has a Ducks sign on it. And there's also a Papa Murphy's on that city block and a used clothes store called Plato's Closet, which I know is a good landmark for people. Anyhow, there used to be a car dealership on that property area, and it had an underground storage tank to, you know, fill up cars, like, right as, you know, you sold them, just do a little last, like, oh, and we'll give you a free tank of gas, right? Like a little extra cherry on top for selling a car. And that place leaked in sometime in the 1990s. And when it was decommissioned in 1997, they discovered petroleum contamination, had to register with the Department of Environmental Quality and hire a group of consultants to interface between them as the business owners and the Department of Environmental Quality. And they tried to clean this up in a couple different ways. One, they did some tests. They found it was dangerous in terms of levels of benzene, toluene, ethyl benzene, and xylene, right? So we knew the pollution was dangerous. And they decided, we'll do a soil excavation to get rid of it. And so they dug up the asphalt of that small northeast corner on 17th and Oak Street across from the Safeway and excavated soil. And when I read the reports, they noted that there was a substantial amount of contaminated soil below the current Wells Fargo building and below the current Plato's Closet building. And there was also natural gas infrastructure in there. So they decided that it's too expensive to remove that contaminated soil because then we'd have to destroy the building and that's just a lot of money. So they let the Department of Environmental Quality know, hey, we did a soil excavation, but we left some of it there because who wants to pay for that? And the Department of Environmental Quality said, that's great to hear. You did a soil excavation. We're still concerned that there's a lot of dangerous pollution below here, though, especially given that you left some. So the environmental consultants sat around for a few years and eventually did some more tests, and they reported back to the Department of Environmental Quality that there's still enough contamination there. And the Department of Environmental Quality was like, you have to do something about that. You can't just...
Good. I'm glad they said you have to do something about it.
Oh, we're just in the beginning of the story.
Oh, no.
The year is 2003. We're 6 years after the initial leak was discovered. And in 2001 was when the petroleum soil removal happened. And so, yeah, good on the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here with you. They held them a little more accountable. And so they did some tests, confirmed there are still high levels. And they said, okay, we're going to remove the asphalt so that the soil can just off-gas the pollution into the ambient environment around it, where people live and work. And we're going to inject it with hydrogen peroxide, which we think will increase the volatilization of these chemicals and get them into the air and out of the ground at a more rapid pace. So they do a hydrogen peroxide injection and let it sit for another 4 years. So in 2005, they did the hydrogen peroxide injection 8 years after the leak was discovered. And in 2009, the DEQ said, we'd really like to know if that worked. And so in 2009, the environmental consultants went back and did some more testing. And guess what they found? High levels of benzene and other pollution that are still dangerous to future land uses.
Of course they did. Of course they did.
Of course they did. The DEQ was like, you still really gotta do something about this. And so they decided to let it aerate for a while longer and sort of sit there. And eventually, around the year 2019, the DEQ was like, hi, we asked for you to do something about this. Do something.
A million years ago.
Right, you know, it's been 20 years since the initial leak. It's been two decades.
You've had some time to figure it out.
And the environmental consultants went back and remeasured benzene in the soil and groundwater, and they found levels of benzene that are not okay for residential development. And part of the leaking underground storage tank cleanup involves this party deciding what are future land uses in this area likely going to be. And one of them was high density residential development. It's a great place to develop apartments in Eugene. And as you and I talked about earlier, the residential standard for exposure to this pollution is much higher, or much more, I should say, lower and more stringent than a worker standard. So the whole time they've acknowledged that there's too much pollution for anyone who lives in the area and any future residents in the area, but not enough to where it constitutes a risk, I'm putting this in air quotes, to workers. You and I, Arjorie, know, because we work in environmental justice and in pollution, that workers matter too. And right, so you and I would instantly say, yeah, this is still not acceptable to anyone. If you're working an 8-hour shift there 5 days a week, that's still a lot of pollution to be exposed to. And you and I would argue that we don't want that. But by the DEQ's rules, technically workers are allowed to be exposed to this. Anyways, these environmental consultants found high rates of benzene. And you know what they said to the DEQ?
What?
We think our tests are wrong. You know, like, we found high levels of benzene, but like, they're wrong. So like, let us off the hook is essentially what they said.
They've been doing this for 20 years. It's enough. Right? You're caught.
You went to your lab professor and said, you know, I think I did these tests and they're wrong. It's not an acceptable result. No. You can't go to your boss and be like, yeah, I tried and it didn't really work out.
Can you imagine, like, if we said that to Lisa?
No, we would be in so much trouble.
I'm sorry.
Be like, get your butt back to work. Yeah. Like, figure it out. This is a really good example because it shows how the dialogue between environmental consultants and the DEQ is, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the DEQ kind of gets to put a mild, like, you know, nudge, like, you got to do the right thing. And then the environmental consultants, is their objective is to save, you know, the owner of that property any amounts of money. So they're going to do the least amount of work possible to get a no further action letter. And I think this pattern is important to illuminate. And what I'd like to highlight at the end of the story is it's 2023. They have not gone back and done new tests. Actually, it's 2024. It's the new year, right? It has been 27 years since the initial discovery of that leak. And we know there's petroleum contaminated soil below that building that was never removed, right? And this is stuff that needs to be landfilled for eternity. It's not something like, it'll off-gas and go away, but not in an acceptable way that's not going to endanger people living on the property. So luckily, all of this is covered in asphalt. So if you're, you know, near the area, you're probably doing okay. But I personally have a lot of questions about these workers that are in the nearby buildings. And environmental consultants even argued that the Wells Fargo and that tire center right to the south, where they noted 20 years ago there was petroleum contaminated soil, should not be included as a building we should be worried about for workers' exposure, even though they found high rates of benzene 6 feet away from that building. I think this shows the leeway that these environmental consultants are allowed to make their arguments. And I think that there are lessons in here that are worth looking into and thinking about in terms of polluter pays policies and how insurance companies fit into them.
That's a long 27 years. That's a lot of gentle parenting. So.
That's a lot of leeway that,
yeah,
you know, someone with millions of dollars of resources, I don't think really needs.
No, they don't. Mason, it is always so beautifully and wonderfully nice to have you on the show. This is a long episode. I think that there was a lot of information that needed to be said. Always nice to talk to you. I think that our episodes just generally do last a little bit longer. We just have a good time talking. So
I'm a talker. Yeah.
I am too. And so, you know, I think that that's why this episode got so long. But Mason, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you. Thank you all for being here. Again, I am Arjorie, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.